Jay and I are joined today by Tamika from the House of Phi podcast. We cover her background, what motivated her to find Phi, and her unique take on accelerating her path to FI. You'll knit one to miss this one.
Welcome to Fire Drill Podcast, where side hustles, savings, and creativity lead to financial independence. With your hosts, Gwen from Fiery Millennials and Jay from Millennial Boss.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Fire Drill. We are so thrilled to have Tamika here from House of Phi. Welcome, Tamika.
Hi guys. Hi Jay. Hi Gwen.
Hello. Gwen's here too.
We're super glad to have you on.
Yeah, this is going to be fun.
Mm-hmm. So Tamika, let's kick it off by having you introduce yourself to the listeners.
Yeah, so I'm Tamika. I am a mom. I'm a school nurse. I am on a FIRE journey, which is financial independence, just retire early, as you all know. And I also own a business.
So let's go back to the beginning. Where does your money journey start?
If I think back, you know, you can pull out different memories that come up along the way as you're learning about money. So I will say that I was always naturally a saver. I was never an extreme saver, but I would always save. I always wanted to make a decent salary, and I always wanted more of the stability. My parents on both sides, my parents are both remarried. So both of my dads were, I guess you could call them side hustlers. My one dad, my stepdad, was a DJ on the side, and he'd play parties every weekend. My other dad, my real dad, he does taxes during tax season, and then he works full time throughout the remainder of the year. So I always saw that growing up and having immigrant parents. All of them are from Barbados. There was always a motivation to get a higher education degree and find that stability through a job that makes you a decent salary and income. All of that was going well. I went to a top university in the country. I had a good job, and I kind of lost my way and kind of just started to drift for a while after I got married. I fell into a period of just being comfortable, not necessarily pursuing any particular money goals. And it was when I went through a divorce that I kind of snapped myself awake and began to really change and kind of turbocharge, I guess, my financial situation.
So this is funny, but my dad was a DJ on the side growing up too. And I used to tell people at school, like, my dad's a DJ. And the other kids would be like, your dad's a DJ? What?
Exactly.
It's a different DJ than today, though. Like he wasn't the cool DJs with like the EDM music and the big headphones. I mean, he was like a family parties DJ, but that was cool.
His was more like Chicken Dance and the Macarena
DJ.
Yes,
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So you feel my experience. You can understand. Mine was more, a lot of the people from Barbados would have parties, weddings, all of that. And then he would do the parties on the Saturdays and Sundays. He was actually a part of Clyde and Victor, a DJing duo. So very funny.
Very cool. So you grew up in Barbados?
I actually grew up in Boston.
Oh, okay.
My parents immigrated here before I was born. And I grew up in the south end of Boston, which I could now not afford.
True story. Yep. Very expensive. So, if you don't mind, after your divorce, where were you starting from? I know divorces can be really scary financially and can wreck both parties. Was that your case and you had to dig yourself out of a hole? Or were you comfortable enough to not have to do that?
Well, at the time of my divorce, I had made the switch from being a public accountant to becoming a school nurse. So that was actually my third higher education degree. And at that point, with all of the interest and everything over the years of schooling and not, you know, working, my student loans got up to about $94,000. I had started to pay those off. I had joined the reserves, all of the money from my reserve pay. So an extra, let's say $400 or so was going towards the student loans plus the minimum payments. But I still had quite a bit. I had maybe about $17,000 saved in my savings account. I had a house payment that was a couple thousand dollars, and I had a daughter. So in some respects, I was okay, and in other respects, I wasn't. But when it went from going from two salaries down to one, that's when I started to get a little bit afraid. Like, could I hold the mortgage on my own, on my current salary? How much was it going to cost to get divorced? Would I still be able to add to my savings? I was also saving in retirement, not the way I save now, more in the line of maybe like 10 or 15%. I felt as though any number of things could happen and I could be, you know, out of my home.
Which is pretty much the worst case scenario from a financial stability perspective. That's scary.
Well, it is scary. And it also, it's like, you know, I have a daughter, and even though I had a chunk of money saved up, the divorce costs just for myself alone. And, you know, I have my own views on this now, now that I've been through it, and whether or not I would have paid that same amount. I think it came out to about $6,000, like a $6,000 hit to my savings, my personal savings. And then I wanted to really clean up my finances. So I had a car, I had just little things, maybe a little bit of, I definitely probably had a little bit of credit card debt at the time. I don't know how much. I would say a few cards and spread across those cards, let's say between $1,000 and $3,000 on each of them, I would say. So it was like I had the money to pay those things off, but I was more so focused on accruing money. And so when it came time to just have my bills be under my name, I wasn't budgeting. And so I knew that I needed a clearer picture of my situation, and I did not feel like I had that. And that led me to feel unstable, if that makes sense.
So when does financial independence come into the picture? And how many years ago was what you just described?
I would say that that was about 6 years ago or so. And financial independence came maybe 4 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago. I would have to go back and kind of figure that out. The first thing that came was Dave Ramsey. Sometimes I would go over to my parents' house and they would have on talk radio, and Dave Ramsey came on, and he was just, you know, sometimes in the background just because the radio was playing. And I would always listen to some of those radio stations that come on AM radio when I would go over there. So I think he said he had a podcast, and I went to the phone and downloaded his podcast. And from there, I found other financial podcasts, and I would just listen to the first few episodes, see if I liked them. So I found Joshua Sheets. I found eventually Choose FI, found Fire Drill. But I would say that Dave Ramsey was the first person that I listened to that made me think I needed to do something extreme and radical with my finances.
Yeah, Dave Ramsey is an excellent starting point for the vast majority of the American population. You know, like, live within your means, stop putting things on credit cards if you can't afford it. He's a really good starting point. So I think that's an excellent place where you started from.
I completely agree with you. I'm so glad that I found him. It was when I got to those higher levels, like I paid everything off down from 17,000 minus the 6,000 for the lawyer. I won't say stupid lawyer, for the lawyer. And then I drew everything down to that $1,000, and I maybe stayed around $2,000. It just was very scary for me, but I paid off the car. I paid off a few things. It was when I got to that debt-free place that I found that I needed some more, just like a higher or deeper level understanding. So yes, Dave Ramsey, I agree. Perfect starting point. He gets you into a really extreme, like, hyper-focused mindset. And then later, it's nice to come to a place like what we talk about and just do some optimizing in different ways.
So now that your goal is financial independence, what does that goal mean to you personally?
I've always worked. I started working at 14. So I don't really know what I would do if I wasn't doing something. And so for me, I'm definitely more focused on the FI side than the retire early side. I'm focused on my first goal is once I hit my pension from my full-time job, which is in another 3 years, I want to take a year off and just kind of stay home. So that's something that I actively save for. I know what my expenses are for the year, my annual expenses. And so every year for the last, let's say, 5 years, I've been putting aside money that when I take that year off, and it's called a sabbatical year, it's something where people do it and they'll save your position for a year and then you can go back into your position after that time. And I definitely want to take advantage of that, but I will have the money for it. After that, I don't know what my absolute goal will be, but I do know I would love to start more businesses And if I was financially independent, and not just that, but if I was just, you know, if I won the lottery tomorrow, I would start businesses. I love it. It's exciting. I love to grow it. I love to put your creative stamp on them. And I think that's what I would do full time.
I think we're very liking that. So question, you're a school nurse and they allow sabbaticals. Sabbaticals always seem to me something like you could do if you were a professor or you work for a new age tech company or something. They let school nurses do that?
Yeah. So in this system, we are technically treated as though we are teachers. We're similar to teachers. And so there have been nurses who have left. There have been physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists who have left for a year and they've either gone abroad or done some research. You can definitely take a sabbatical. They hold your position for a year. You go right back into the same position. You have to apply to do it, but it's definitely something that if I'm not quite ready to leave school nursing at that time, I would definitely do that and in that year make that decision.
And where do you want to go in that year?
Well, I've had a few thoughts. It kind of depends on what my husband is able to do as well. But I've gone back and forth between, okay, would I try to start another business in that year? Would I try to just be there with my kids for that year? My youngest son will be around 7 at that time. And then I have one child that would be 13 at that time. She's 10 now. And another that would be 15 at that time. So it's kind of a good time to be with them for that one full solid year where I could go and read to the class or go to all the field trips. If we were able to do it, I would also like to, you know, like if my husband could also take the time, travel. And I would actually take them out of school. I have a friend who homeschools. I would probably take them out of school if I could. I don't know if we would be ready to in 3 years, but it's something that I would definitely be interested in.
Is your husband on board for your fire plans?
Oh, boy. My husband is totally on board, but
I was going to say, there feels like there's a but there.
Yeah, yeah. He would prefer to just take direction versus actually living and breathing and learning and being in the whole fire sphere. I love it so much that I write about it. I'll talk about it. I'll listen to podcasts about it. I just love it. And he is not that way. So he's on board. He does what I say. You can make so much, you can get so much traction if you're both on board. And so at least I can get that traction. But I feel like we would be able to move to my goals and his goals even faster if he felt like a fire about it. It is what it is. And I'm very thankful that he's at least not the opposite, which is somebody who isn't interested at all and is making all of the horrible choices that are kind of working against you. It's tough when you're balancing it all with someone else and you're the one who's into the details. So actually, I just wrote a post and we don't really have to go into, you know, my website or anything, but I just wrote a post because we actually ended up owing taxes this year. We did them early. We haven't submitted them, but we did them early because I like to know. The problem that I had was that I explained something to him about the new tax code, but I didn't go in and actually check on it and make sure that it was done correctly. And so he underwithheld and we owe some money. So it's things like that. It's like I would have to do my stuff and little things that I don't want to do, like checking his statements and stuff. That would be much easier if he were truly, truly on fire about fire, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I have the same thing in my relationship. My husband, and this is a common mistake that I did too, but when you have an HSA, a health savings account, you have to actually choose to invest the money. Like you have to click and buy in the account. Otherwise, it just sits there. So he was like, oh, look, this money is just sitting there for the past 4 years. I'm like, what? So yeah, but you know, on the other side, I like being in control of things. So does it bother me that I get to make the decisions? No, not really, to be honest.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me at all. I don't care about the HSA. That's a small thing. Overall, though, we kind of like divide and conquer what areas we add the most value. Like financially is me, health and wellness. That's all him. I just listen to whatever he says and it works.
That's fun.
Yes, it is fun. It's worked out.
I was going to say, meanwhile, the only person that I can get mad at for not doing anything is me. It works out well because I make myself really happy and really mad sometimes.
Well, yeah, I've been there too. So, and then there are obviously things that come out to be my fault. So all of this is personal finance. All of it's so fluid. And the good thing is that if you're in a situation where you at least make a certain salary or you know, I don't know, the resources, you can definitely dig yourself out of any hole. And it's just sometimes frustrating to get back into the holes. So I hear ya.
So let's talk about your entrepreneurship journey. You hear of some people who were an entrepreneur at age 8 with a lemonade stand and were doing these crazy things. Was that your experience? And if it wasn't, what made you finally take action and do it?
It wasn't my experience. I never sold anything besides candy. But I do remember this guy, and I don't know if I've ever said this before, but there was this guy. So I was selling candy because I was in the honors choir in high school, which is like, okay, whatever. I was in this honors choir and we were trying to make money to go to Italy. And so I was selling candy. I sold so much candy and made a lot of money for us to go. There was this guy who was not in, and he started selling candy just to become a millionaire. He said, I want to become a millionaire. So he started selling candy, and I would take the little box around. Like, I get a box of Snickers from BJ's or Costco's. It was BJ's at the time. And I would get a little box of the Sour Patch Kids, which are obviously my favorite. I would have this thing and I'd go around and I'd keep replenishing and everything. And he created this huge, I mean, it had straps. He strapped it around his neck. And then it was this huge pan-like box, like a lid, that had all of these chocolates and candies in rows and would sell them every day until finally he got shut down. And I just remember him being the first person I heard, which was in high school, saying, I'm going to be a millionaire, and him doing an entrepreneurial endeavor in order to try to reach that goal. I think that because my parents were immigrants and because there was already like this scripted way of moving from point A to final success, I didn't really have the bug or the creativity or the courage or something to take any entrepreneurial leaps. But later on, when I had some money, I had a decent job, I had time, you know, as a school nurse, you get the summers off, I'm on vacation this week. So I had time, I had money, and I actually started by creating my first ever product, which was a breastfeeding product. And then it was later that I found the Lice Clinic, which is the business, the brick and mortar business that I own now. I think that if I was just raised in a different type of household with a little more flexibility and creativity, or even with parents who were true entrepreneurs, I would definitely have done it earlier.
Did you feel at all it was a confidence thing? I know for me in the past, I didn't really want to put myself out there. When you have something that you're selling, you're going in front of people and you're saying, hey, I have this thing. I'm selling this thing. And if there's a little tension on you and it could fail or people don't like it, that was a mental hurdle for me. And even with the tattoos, last year I brought them to the Women's March. First of all, people are like, why are you selling things at the Women's March? You should be giving them away for free. You're an evil person, but that's okay. I made so much money because people love the feminist temporary tattoos there. But it just like you're putting yourself in front of these people and then you have a mini panic attack of like, oh my God, this is going to go awful. But then it ended up being really great. And it was kind of like a confidence hurdle that I had to get over to be an entrepreneur. Mm. Did you have that at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so many components to becoming an entrepreneur. There's being able to speak in front of people, being able to convince people of ideas, and selling in general. It takes a lot of practice and you don't like to hear no. You don't know what you did wrong. And there's just so many components that putting yourself out there in that first, those first few times is really tough. I definitely think that that's the case. I was a more shy person when I was younger. I like to learn an area or a room before I try to lead the room, I guess. And so I would definitely say that courage and, you know, not being shy, being open and just sharing yourself and believing in yourself is something that had to come about for me to make the leap.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting because I started out as a Girl Scout. So I went around and hawked Girl Scout cookies to everybody and everybody. And the day that cookies went out, I would run around to the entire neighborhood and get everybody and hit them up on the first night that I could. Like, literally was out for like hours and wouldn't eat dinner that night just so I could get that jump on my fellow scouts and get everybody. And so, like, I was top cookie seller in my troop for like 4 years running, something crazy like that. But then I don't know if it's necessarily like things changed, but I really hate rejection. And so I went to go work for Toys R Us, and they insisted upon the fact that you had to ask everybody if they wanted to sign up for a credit card and if they had the Toys R Us rewards card. I don't know what it was, but I think that's what turned me off of sales, is having to hawk this product that was awful for people. The interest rates on this credit card were like 26%. And the only people that signed up were people that definitely should not have been adding another credit card. I just refused to do it. And I think that's what made me hate sales, because like, I loved peddling Girl Scout cookies to my neighborhood because everybody loved Girl Scout cookies.
Everyone loves them. Yeah.
Right? Who's going to turn down Girl Scout cookies? Ironically, I can't eat them anymore because of the gluten. Yeah. So I went from like being really good at selling a product that I loved and that the public has a very good perception of to like hating to have to hawk this product that is bad for people. And so it kind of depends on what you're selling too, right?
Oh yeah. I would definitely say that's the case. Actually, the two things that I wanted to, the breastfeeding product was supposed to make returning back to work and still trying to pump easier, because it's the most horrible experience ever to try to find a place, and like you want to not give your baby formula and you have to go back to work. Like, it's just already stressful. And I didn't have to go through it the first time with my daughter, but I did have to go through it with my son. And that's where I found this issue with the lice. And I could talk more about that if you guys want to. You are literally seeing people come in hysterical and leave with a huge smile. The kids have lollipops. They're lice-free, they're clean, and all they have to do now is they don't have to touch their hair again besides wash it. They don't have to touch their hair again. All they have to do now is go home and just clean out their space. It's happiness every time you make a sale. So I could see why trying to get people to sign up for high-interest credit cards that they don't need, it doesn't make you feel good every time you make a sale.
No, but if you have a negative mindset towards selling anything, like Gwen, I know that you and I have had these conversations in the past, and now that I know where it's coming from the Toys R Us experience, I kind of get it. In order to be an entrepreneur, you have to have confidence in the value that you're providing. You have to.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, it's not, I mean, you can practice it and you can learn it and stuff, but it's going to be so much harder. I don't think any of us had it when we first started. Like, I just went out like a weirdo and just failed, and it was a big mess. But then after time, you kind of develop it.
Yeah, it's definitely a skill I try to develop with my kids. Speaking in front of people, just talking about things that you have that people should watch or see. I try to make my daughter especially do that. So she has a Minecraft channel, which, you know, I try to teach her. It's about talking and writing out a little bit of a script, an outline before you get started, and then knowing the video stuff and showing it. And then you have to do the part afterwards where you tell people about it, or else who's going to find it? And that's really the part that I have to remind her. And it's not so that she has this million views on her Minecraft channel. She's way far away from that. She has like 50 views, but still, it's more about going out, talking about what you have. If you really believe that you're doing a good job and it's something that people will enjoy.
Gwen, I really do respect your Girl Scouts hustle though, because I can totally see little Gwen like knocking on all the doors and everything.
It was a competition, right? Like, I wasn't competing against myself or like competing to sell the product. I was competing for a badge and recognition from my troop on being top cookie seller, right?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I had a different experience with the Girl Scouts, and this is me not being mature enough to realize that I had control over selling them. But as someone who was a little bit less affluent than the other girls in my town, I would just see them hit up all their wealthy friends and family. And then I'd be like, oh, Amanda won. Like, no wonder, she's rich. You know what I mean? Like, that takes a lot of maturity for you to be like knocking on doors. It could also be my town. No one knocked on your door unless it was like a Jehovah's Witness or something. So it was very rare to knock on doors.
Like, literally the only people that knocked on your doors when I was growing up were Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, and maybe some lost person who was
what?
Like, literally, I've lived in a planned neighborhood kind of far from town. And so like the only people that went to your neighborhood were people that lived in your neighborhood. Like there's no other reason for people to be out there.
Well, you were a little hustler.
Well, you were a hustler for sure. That's where you developed those social skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, like it was a lot easier to go up to a door and be a representative for somebody else. It wasn't about me. I was just the conduit, right? So like I put that vest on with all of my patches that displayed what I did. And I walked up to that door and I said, "Hi, would you like to buy Girl Scout cookies?" And who's going to say no to an 8-year-old, right? Like they'll buy a pity box at least. And that's all that mattered.
Right. Yeah. When but it's like, your own product, it's different.
Yeah. But like those people were genuinely happy to see me at their door. Like, "Oh, Girl Scout cookies. Yeah. Is it that time of year again already? Like, let's do this."
Yeah. I guess the key when I think about sales, it's not selling to anyone. It's like finding the people that are super qualified leads where like, this is what they need. You have this solution. And then forgetting about the other people who are just going to not need this. And it's going to be awful for both of you.
And it totally will be awful for both of you. So right. you definitely have to find that person. If people come into the clinic and they say, "Oh, I only have this much money left," or whatever, I don't try to sell them on a treatment. I try to sell them on a comb, you know, and I try to show them what to do with it. You know, you could do it yourself. It's going to take longer. It's going to be harder, but you could do it yourself. And if that's what you can afford, you should not be paying for the super luxe service. And that makes me feel better. And I don't want to deal with trying to oversell somebody who I don't want to feel creepy and I don't want them to feel pressured. So,
right. Totally. Okay. So now that we talked about the mindset of starting a business, which I'm glad we got into this because that is kind of 90% of it in a lot of cases, you just got to gear yourself up to just do it. Can we just quickly talk about literally how you did it with the Lice Clinic? And, you know, you're a nurse. So I think I first heard you on another podcast and I'm like, "Oh, only nurses can do this." And then I heard you mention on another podcast that actually there are a lot of non-nurses who just started a business like this. So when you first kind of got the idea, what did you do? Like, what are the steps that you did? Did you have a certain amount of money that it cost to buy into the business? Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I did a lot of research. So I had the thought, can nurses do this? Or, you know, have to have a hair license? So, you know, everybody has that mindset where you kind of discount yourself from being able to try something. But in reality, no, you can pretty much do nearly anything with the right amount of capital to start or with the right mindset. Or I should say, and with the right mindset. Actually, we had one of my Lice friends on recently. We haven't released her episode, but her second business, she doesn't work in her Lice clinic anymore. Her second business is she opened poke restaurants, which is it's like seafood and Hawaiian style. It's kind of like Chipotle, but for sushi and seafood. It's done so well.
So good.
And she didn't buy into a franchise. She opened her own. She created the menu. She opened her own with her husband. They are opening the second one. They're going to open a third one. And she has all of those in addition to the Lice Clinic. So she's a cosmetologist. She went to hair school. She didn't go to college. So when you think about the limiting beliefs that we have before we even jump into a type of business, they are there. Even for me to enter the Lice Clinic, to make that initial investment, which was between $20,000 and $30,000 to get started. I even believe that I was limited in that. There are franchises or businesses that cost more to start, but your ability to make more if you put in the work and if you do, you know, learn the ins and outs of businesses, your ability to make, let's say, $1 million in revenue, $500,000 in revenue, is there because of the type of business, but you have to put in even more to get started. So that was a limiting belief for me. I was looking for something smaller to get my feet wet and just get started. And this felt okay to me because $20,000, $25,000, whatever that range of money is the same as buying a new car. And people buy those all the time. So for me, it was a decent amount that I could stomach. But in terms of the mindset, I spoke to as many people as I could. I spoke to that particular person. She's in a few towns over from me. I spoke to others in other states. I have people who are talking to me right now through Facebook or scheduling calls to just talk about Lice clinics to see if it's something that they would be interested in. And honestly, I feel like you really need to do that. If you're going to go into podcasting, blogging, you have to do a little bit of research to know what you're getting yourself into. Soon after, I started to implement some of the systems. So I use a Square tablet. I have cameras so that I can see who's coming, who's going, when people are clocking in, clocking out. I don't really watch it like a hawk or anything. It's more so there for me to be able to review things if need be, which I luckily haven't had to do very much. And paper systems. So everybody has to fill out paperwork before they get started. And that allows me to check the number of treatments and tie that into what's run through the system, meaning through the credit card system. So there are just little things that you want to have in place. You want to have that from the start to the finish process worked out, hammered out.
But at the very beginning, though, for someone maybe who's listening, who's like, I'm interested in doing something like this. I don't know anything about lice, but you know, maybe they live in this random place that doesn't have a lice clinic nearby. Mm-hmm. You figured all that out later with the systems. Like, what did you need to know at the very beginning? Like that 28K, was that, you know, you had to rent a space, you had to fill it up with furniture, you had to buy the thing, you had to get training. Like what was that?
That is all stuff that can be discovered in a phone call. So for instance, I thought of opening a coding space for kids. There's a few of them out there. I called, I spoke to them. The outlay is more like $100,000 and it's just a completely different outlay. So you have that information of what that first set of obstacles is going to be from the company themselves. Any information you get from the company itself, you want to be able to check it against actual people who have gone. It's like any referrals, any reviews that you read on Amazon before you purchase something. You have what the company says, but then you have what the people actually say. And that process takes a little bit of that courage that we were talking about before, because you actually have to get on the phone and call somebody and ask them about their business. And business owners in general, they're like celebrities. Like, it's hard to get over it and just give them a call and reach out.
Just to be clear, when you're saying the company, if I'm a person Googling, what you did was you Googled like the name of the franchise, like the coding camp has a name of like the franchise, and like the lice clinic, you knew the name of what the franchise was, and then you called that company. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. So I wanted to do the coding boot camp or coding for the kids. And so there's like Code Ninjas, and there's a couple of them. They have webinar calls that you can call into and you get their basic information, which is more like a sales pitch. And then it's time for you to actually do the research. With Lerada, which is the people who make the machine for the lice clinics, it was not a franchise when I started. It is a franchise now. So I don't know the process for what they're helping people with now, but at the time that I started, you got trained on the machines. You got a starter pack of products. They basically ran you through, if you sold this many products and you did this many treatments, you'd make this much money and you want to consider these different things. They have a pro forma with different line items that they'll run you through. And you decide if that sounds feasible or not. And then you have to do the research to really decide if those numbers are feasible. Everything else was on my own.
How did you find the people, the real life people? Because I'm sure if the company gives you referrals, they're like their favorite people who do really well. How did you find people?
So they do have a clinic locator on their website. I called Virginia. I felt comfortable with Virginia. I went to school at UVA. I wanted to call Virginia. I called Boston. I called Newton and I called Danvers and I asked them.
Got it. And would they tell you things like their profits and revenue and stuff?
Well, I didn't feel comfortable asking them that. I felt comfortable asking them, how does the day look? How do you find people to come into the clinic? Are you able to cover your expenses? I danced around that. I did not ask them for their direct numbers. It was when I actually went in and I met with the lady from Danvers, who's now a really good friend of mine, that she shared that information with me. By that point, she was maybe the third or fourth person that I spoke to. So I was just in reading her, I felt comfortable pushing a little bit more. And she actually showed me on her computer.
That's great advice. In person, I can totally see that working. So for us, do you have any information to share on if someone's listening and is like, you know what, why not? Why not give this a go? Like, maybe I'll start a lice clinic in my area. Can you share with us any profits that you saw?
In my first year, my highest month of profit was, it took until August. So from the very beginning, I think in my first month, I made, let's say, I don't know, $4,000. I had to spend, let's say, $1,200 or so on the rent. And I was the only one working the clinic. There wasn't much else to cover. I did have cable, phone, internet, but that was a package. That was maybe one something. Now it's down to 80 something dollars because I didn't need the TV. I didn't need the phone. And I had to wait through the 2-year contract to get, you know, to get rid of that. So for Square, when you use Square, you do pay fees. I think they have a 3% or so fee. So, you know, if you make $100, you have to pay the 3% to them. Ordering products. The products can pay your rent, you know, once you're really good at selling and letting people know what exactly do they need. People go to the hairdressers all the time and then they'll leave with shampoos and conditioners. And so I held some of those. Like, I would have like Paul Mitchell and certain things that you could sell because it is a hair place. And so getting on top of your products is also another line of revenue. Beyond that, you can take those online.
So for the full year, would you say like you can put in 28K? In your case, it became a 6-figure business. Is that like rare, or do you know how you compare to your peers in that aspect?
Well, in my case, I became a 6-figure business putting in that amount of money, and I'm in a very saturated area. So for me, that's very good. And I keep my expenses extremely low because I know about FIRE. For other people, so for instance, Lice Aunties or Danvers or wherever, the lady from Danvers who just came on, she hits 100 treatments a month consistently. The treatments are $200. So you can do the simple math, and that's not on top of product sales. It can be a very lucrative business.
Right. Yeah. So hers is like $240,000 a year revenue plus products. So yeah, that's super great. And thank you for sharing that, all the details with us. I mean, even me being a podcaster, I feel awkward being like, so how much money can you make? But it's kind of important, right? Like with all the FIRE thing, we're always, it's all about the numbers, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely important. I think that a lot of times there's not enough information that is shared, but then again, it is, you know, you're still making yourself just open to public and people that you don't know. So I'm more apt to share information personally versus huge numbers with large groups. However, I definitely encourage anybody, everybody who's thinking of any type of business, to really thoroughly do the research, think about the expenses, and run it as, I mean, not as cheaply as you can, but run it as fiscally minded as you can, I guess.
Well, Tamika, thank you so much for giving us all this information today. I mean, we went into your FIRE story. We talked about the mindset of starting a business as the first hurdle, and then physically, like, how do you start your first business? And that was so helpful for me. And now I'm all geared up. I kind of want to do this. I need to find space in my life to spin another plate. I'll be working on that. But yeah, I mean, this got me super excited. I'm like, oh, I should do something like this. But I think there are some, a lot in Seattle, actually, because I heard my coworkers talking about them. So I'd have to see if, you know, but to your point, it doesn't have to be a lice clinic. I mean, you were looking into the coding camp too. There are tons of different franchises that people could find out about.
Yeah. And I don't actually know if franchising, maybe I can come on again and talk about franchising versus licensing versus really truly starting something on your own. Franchising the first time around and licensing even with Lerata was me opening a business with, like I say, training wheels on. And so now I definitely feel like I could just create my own business.
Got it. Yeah, we definitely should have a follow-up or maybe some type of like YouTube video series. We haven't done one of those in a while.
Oh, that would be fun. Yeah, let's do that.
Yes. But speaking of being private, you'd have to do it with Gwen because I don't do YouTube videos, unfortunately.
Yeah, I've seen Gwen. Gwen has been all about the videos.
You yes. and me. Let's do it.
Yes. Yes. Well, Tamika, if people want to connect with you and learn more about you, where can they find you?
Well, I blog at reluctantfrugalist.com, and I also am on the House of Fi podcast, which talks about the Fi movement for families.
Great. And Gwen, do you want to ask the last question?
Absolutely. I'm very curious to hear how this one's going to go. So, Tamika, if you could have anything, do anything, be anything in the world, what is your wildest dream?
You know, I know that you guys asked this question, and for some reason, I did not prepare for that answer. So if I could do anything, what would be my wildest dream?
We stumped her, Jay.
Yes. Well, I'm going to have to go with the dream that I already have, I guess, because I could say fly, or I could say, like, oh, I would like to be in a few movies, but that's not very wild. My family and I like to do all, like, we watch all of the Marvel movies. So if I could have been in, like, pretty much all of them, that would have been kind of cool. And maybe been, like, I don't know, Black Widow or something. That would have been kind of cool. But I'm going to have to go, yeah, that, like, being a stunt woman or knowing how to really fight and be in excellent shape would be, like, that would just be so cool. And my kids would just love it. And I love it. So, but I won't say that one. I will just say, I think if I could, I would own 100 businesses. That's what I'll say. If I could, I would clone myself in that way.
An army of clones with Black Widow skills, making money. Amazing.
I'm kind of scared now.
Yeah, exactly. Red. All right, Tamika. Well, thank you so much. I love your podcast. So I recommend everyone check that out, House of Fi. And thanks for coming on.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Go to our website, firedrillpodcast.com, to continue the discussion and get the link to our private Facebook group.
If you like us, leave us a review on iTunes. If you're like me, you have no idea how to do that. So in the podcast app or in iTunes, search for Fire Drill Podcast, find it, click the reviews tab, and write something to make my mother proud of me. We read every single review and want to say thank you from the bottom of our hearts for making this podcast possible.